Hi everyone, I'm Priti, and it's a real pleasure to be here with you all this morning. It's a real honor to get to present here. The names in addition to mine on this slide are my co-authors and fantastic colleagues, some of whom are here in the room. I'd also like to, if you're interested in this idea of networks in the context of organizations that serve individuals living with HIV, I'd also like to point out one of the other authors, Dr. Nidhi Khosla, who's presenting a poster on networks as well. So please note that I have no relationship to disclose. So today I'll be presenting on the interaction among organizations that serve individuals living with HIV. So first I want to give you some context and lay the groundwork a little bit, then I'll describe the methods, results, conclusions, and some of the plans for dissemination. So this work is part of an initiative called Positive Charge, which is a 5-site HIV linkage and retention and care program that took place at 5 different locations around the U.S. So it's called Positive Charge, and it took place from 2010 to 2013. This was an innovative initiative led by a group called AIDS United that's since been followed by 19 similar programs. These were the 5 sort of trailblazing programs. So while Positive Charge sites were highly successful in linking and retaining out-of-care individuals in care, in this presentation, what I'll be instead focusing on is the key part of the structure that enabled them to do that. So in particular, we'll be examining how the lead grantee, so the 5 organizations that are shown here, how they were able to collaborate with other local organizations to be able that served individuals living with HIV to be able to conduct their programs. We'll be looking at this quantitatively using network analysis, and we'll provide some insights into the specific ways that organizations collaborated with one another. Before going forward, I just wanted to mention that this work really would not have been possible without the vision and support of AIDS United, so I'm really grateful for their incredible leadership in this important area. So I mentioned earlier that these programs ran from 2010 to 2013, and I want to give you just a little bit more background information about how the grants worked, since that'll become important a little bit later. So the structure was that a lead agency, kind of symbolized by this red circle in the center of the slide, great, I can do this, I'm glad you pointed that out, was responsible for strategic leadership of the program, but also recruiting sub-grantees to work with and dispersing funds among them. The grant required at least 2 collaborators. So as everyone in this room knows, linking and retaining individuals living with HIV who aren't accessing ongoing HIV primary care is key to ending the US HIV epidemic. I'm sure that everybody has seen this diagram many, many times, but I just wanted to include it here to kind of contextualize and ground this presentation. Of course, all of our presentations here today are focusing on the second bar, increasing engagement in care. And some of the challenges involved in this work are that many of the individuals who aren't linked to ongoing HIV care have many unmet basic needs, such as stable housing, untreated mental illnesses, ongoing substance abuse issues. And these were some of the often cited barriers that we also found in seeking and keeping up with medical care among Positive Charge participants. Okay, so how are these individuals getting services, and what organizations are they connected to? In general, this population is often served by a network of loosely connected agencies that include organizations that many of you may be representing, so such as AIDS service organizations, local health departments, and local clinics. Because each of these organizations has their own missions and their own metrics for success, they may or may not be able to collaborate in a way that optimizes outcomes for their clients or patients, depending on what type of organization it is. In addition, some of the needs that I referred to earlier, such as providing treatment for mental illness or substance abuse or housing, those may be above and beyond what one of these organizations can do alone. So drawing upon the literature from some related fields, such as mental health, and actually the literature in business, these literature from these fields suggests that collaboration between organizations has a variety of advantages. I'm just going to go through some of them. It can increase organizational efficiency and performance, decrease duplication of efforts across the network, increase each individual organization's power and legitimacy, achieve a greater number of process outcomes, foster trust and valuing of different collaborators, foster agreement on highest priority outcomes, better use resources, and ensure the avail rare resources into this network of organizations. That being said, this type of collaboration, which is called inter-organizational collaboration, and that is a mesh term in case anyone is curious to learn more about it later. So inter-organizational collaboration has not yet been demonstrated to improve population health outcomes. So that's one kind of gap in the literature. There is some literature from the HIV world as well, but not nearly as much from mental health or from business, which was another driver for doing this research. So to tell you why this work is important, in addition to the fact that the evidence base on inter-organizational collaboration among HIV-focused organizations is still growing, this type of collaboration can boost services and care for a population in an area without the investment of new resources or training of new personnel necessarily. In fact, during some of the recent presentations on the updated US National HIV/AIDS strategy, this type of inter-organizational collaboration, that phrase is a mouthful, was mentioned many, many times. So I think that kind of underscores the importance of looking at this issue a little bit more rigorously. Okay, so what research questions did we try to answer? So with a grant structure like this, which I've kind of reiterated here just to jog your memory, it was anticipated that grantees would form tighter connections with the sub-grantees that they were collaborating with. Right? This seems fairly obvious. But the extent to which those lead organizations and sub-grantee partners would connect, we didn't know the extent, and we also didn't know whether those increased collaborations would just be between kind of the lead organizations and their sub-grantees, or would they be among the sub-grantees as well. That was another thing that we didn't know. So we also wanted to take a look at the frequency of collaboration and the type of collaboration that occurred. For type of collaboration, we examined four different types. One was referrals back and forth between organizations, sharing resources, exchanging information, and technical assistance. Oops, sorry about that. See if I can back this up. Alright, I think we're okay. Okay, so we administered one-time surveys to staff at each organization. This screenshot just represents kind of what that online survey would look like. And this is actually, this one happens to be from AIDS Foundation Chicago, which is sort of appropriate given where we are. These online surveys asked about the presence or absence of collaboration with particular organizations at the time of the survey, which is about a year into the grant, and 6 months prior to the start of the grant. Surveys also asked about the type of collaboration that I mentioned earlier, those four types, and their frequency. And we took frequency and we dichotomized it into at least monthly or more than monthly. All of the questions were generally asked in checklist form, which is a fairly common way to ascertain network connectedness, and other researchers such as Masseri and Quite have used these techniques previously. So as I said before, we used techniques from network analysis to quantify connectedness among each lead and sub-grantee inter-organizational network. So we used two specific measures. The first is density, and density is simply the number of connections divided by the total number of possible connections. So existing connections divided by, this is a fraction in the air, I guess, existing connections divided by total possible number of connections. And as with all proportions, it ranges between 0 and 1. And then network centralization is the second thing that we looked at, and that's what I'm trying to illustrate here with this diagram. So network centralization is just a measure of the extent to which all of the connections in a network are due to one and only one organization. So that situation is what we see on the left, where we see here that network centralization is 1, so meaning this organization in the center accounts for all of the connections. Network centralization here on the right is less than 1, because this central organization isn't responsible for all of the connections. So once we got all our survey responses, we turned them into matrices and loaded them into UCINET for analysis. Right. Now let's move to the results. So as you might have guessed, each of the networks became more tightly connected. And you can see on this slide that with the exception of Chicago, where all of the organizations were already connected prior to the grant, the density doubled. So that means that the number of connections between organizations in a network more than doubles in each of these cases. So let's take a look at that a little bit more visually. So this is one of the sites was Louisiana. And this is a sociogram which just represents the connections between organizations. So each of the blue dots is called a node, in case you're curious, and each of those represents one organization, and the line between the two represents the connection between that organization. So fairly intuitive. So this is what Louisiana's looked like 6 months prior to the start of the grant. This is what it looked like during the grant, so you can see the kind of stark difference there. Chicago, as I said, all the organizations were already connected 6 months prior to the grant. So during the grant, they remained connected. North Carolina's program actually wasn't just in like one city or one region of North Carolina. It was spread across the state. And the state's a pretty big place. It takes 7 hours to drive across it. So it doesn't look that big on a map, but it's actually a pretty big place. So these organizations weren't very well connected 6 months prior to the grant, but were very well connected during the grant. And we see the same thing with the fifth site, which is the San Francisco Bay Area. So we see that same change. So what's interesting is that this is, for the most part, not driven by one central organization, as we can see from all these diagrams. So that's exciting. What that means is that a grant structure like this can not only boost connections between a lead grantee and its sub-grantees in an area, but also among those sub-grantees in an area that form collaborations outside and independently of that original lead grantee and sub-grantee relationship. And because you don't necessarily just have to hear it from me, one thing I didn't mention was that positive charge actually had a qualitative analysis component as well. So I'll let one of the staff members describe the effects of this network collaboration in their own words. So what the staff member says is, without the network, it would have been hard because we are a grassroots organization and they are a county level organization. But because we both have this grant, it gives us that container to saying we should be working together. And this quote is actually described in this paper that just came out in AIDS Education and Prevention. There's two back-to-back qualitative papers that describe positive charge, so if you want to look at it more from that perspective. All right, so more results. So as I mentioned before, density of course increased, but we also wanted to look at what does that mean? How are organizations actually interacting with one another? So what we found was that referrals were sort of the most often. Referrals and information sharing were done most often. And in general, all of these increased. So information sharing was the most common, sorry, I misspoke, followed by referrals, followed by technical assistance, and finally resource sharing. And when I say resource sharing, I mean like staff stationed at each other's organizations and things like that. Results from previous studies suggest that this type of informal collaboration, such as information sharing and referrals back and forth, can and does happen more easily. So other studies have found the same thing. And the reasons for that may be that it doesn't require that same high-level coordination and management buy-in that resource sharing or technical assistance might involve. Another reason is that information and referrals can be done kind of with client-facing staff who form relationships with one another and doesn't depend as much on administrative staff in the way that resource sharing or technical assistance might. So in general, a grant that's structured like this can boost network connectivity in a local area, or not so local as in the case of North Carolina. And in addition, the interactions that occur between these organizations will not just be between the lead grantees and their sub-grantees, but also amongst their sub-grantees. And this type of interaction between organizations is, we know from this and from other studies, more likely to be around information sharing and referrals between organizations than it is to be about technical assistance and resource sharing. There are some limitations as well as further research questions. One thing I kind of alluded to at the very beginning in the background, which was that no studies have really looked at whether or not interorganizational collaboration actually boosts population health outcomes. So that's one sort of next step. Another thing that we weren't able to look at here but would be really fantastic to find out is the extent to which these connections were sustained after the grant ceased in 2013. And other questions arising from the study is that while it's fantastic that more individuals can receive the types of services they need from a better coordinated group of organizations, and like I said, that doesn't take more investment of resources or personnel necessarily, is this really a better model than wraparound services? And when I say that, what I mean is having all of the services under one roof, right? Your mental health clinician is here, your doctor is here, your pharmacy is here, and they're all together, and you know, you get to go between. I would love to do that, right? That'd be great for me. I'm sure other folks here agree with me. And we have information from during the grant, but it would be really great to see if there are any sort of additional outcomes of this collaboration, right? Like, do these organizations work together to leverage future funding? So just some next steps about talking a little bit about dissemination. So all of the information that I presented today will be available in much, much greater detail, both as a peer-reviewed publication in Health Education and Behavior, so sort of like yours where I thought I had seen your paper actually before you presented. So this is not out yet, but will be out soon. The qualitative papers that I mentioned will be available in, are available currently in health education and prevention, and I think they came out last week. And in greater context, this work will be described in an upcoming book called Improving Access to HIV Care, Lessons Learned from 5 U.S. Sites, and that's coming out through the Johns Hopkins University Press, so our representative is right here, and that'll be in January of 2016. And also, just to let you all know that these analyses are being used in future work with AIDS United, so AIDS United's advocacy initiative called Southern Reach will also be looking at the extent to which the grant can influence or what kind of effect that has on the interorganizational networks and to what extent interorganizational networks form beyond the sort of usual suspects in HIV organizations, if you will. So I just wanted to say thank you so much to all of the 5 positive charge grantees, to the American Public Health Association for this opportunity, to AIDS United, and to all of positive charge staff and participants, and to all of you for your attention and for, you know, sticking it through the 4th presentation. I really appreciate it. So thank you. Great question. So what we did was we, of course, included the lead organization and whoever they reported that they were working with. So we went off of that since, you know, Hopkins, where I was sitting while I was doing this work, is contracted as an evaluator. So the lead organizations were best positioned to articulate that. That being said, I think a lot of the previous work that's looked at networks of HIV organizations has done has really looked at all of the organizations in an area and has, you know, approached one organization and asked them, like, who is everybody in the area, and asked them about every single organization. So ours is a little bit different than that, right? Like, ours is bounded by this grant, whereas I think previous work has just looked at every single organization or person in an area. So, yeah, go ahead.
Have you ever thought of using your analysis for the Ryan White Act? Because those, the way they are funded is their organization provides the service
No, I've never done that, but I am a PhD student. I'm always looking for more data and more papers to write and more things to do. So if that's a potential collaboration, I'm excited. I saw one more hand. Yeah. The way we asked the question was, I think I have it on here. The way we asked the question was presence or absence.
Okay, so it's whether or not it existed, not necessarily your
breaking of that relationship. Exactly. So this is how it was worded. Like, does your organization collaborate with the following in the implementation? Yes, no, or I work for the organization.
You know, like the breaking of the smaller agencies.
And that's something that I think the qualitative can really talk to a little bit more about. And that's something that, kind of speaking from the qualitative piece, that differed from group to group. So certain groups felt like this really put us all on the map, like our collaboration is really strengthening our ability to go after these big national grants we never would have otherwise. And for other groups, it felt like, okay, this is a change in how we do things. So I think that's something I feel like those sorts of like processes and interactions, I think, are a good qualitative question, which we were able to look at in this book context a little bit better. Go ahead.
So, as somebody who lives in North Carolina, I'm curious, so what were the bounds of collaboration across agencies? I see that it's treated at Duke, that there's people who are awake, the linkage to engagement and care wouldn't necessarily be as useful, right, because you're not going to have somebody living in the eastern part of the state and taking care in the western part of the state. So thinking about What
it meant to be collaborating in this context was these were really the organizations that were focused not necessarily on the delivery of care, but on the linkage and retention in care. So finding participants, supporting them and staying linked to care, you know, case management, those types of activities. So these collaborations are primarily between those organizations. Sometimes there's a medical organization as well, but that really depended on the network itself. So, but I agree with you that, you know, the services that a singular patient is or client is getting are going to be within their geography, right? Like, nobody's going to be driving
across
the state.
Right, and that's what I was curious. Yeah, you, like, North Carolina was a state, and then Chicago, New York, and so, you know, like, where the contact really is varies.
Right.
And you mentioned this, but you don't have any information so close to the grant ending as to what happens to
no, not data. Right, I don't have any data. I mean, I think, you know, you can sort of talk to the funders and talk to the organizations and kind of get a sense, but sort of once the grant ended, we didn't really have like an entree into saying like, please fill out more surveys for us. You know, we didn't really sort of have the ability to do something like that. So.
And were those formalized partnerships? So did they have some random understanding, or is just, as you were mentioning, they said that they were collaborating with?
These are more formal. There's potential for it to, and I mean, I think, let's see, for some of the organizations that were shown here, they actually did get, some of them, not all of the ones described here, did get follow-on funding to do more linkage and retention work, so I do know for a fact that some of these collaborations did continue, but again, I don't have, like, data to point to or surveys to be able to quantify that. I can only kind of anecdotally tell you that because, you know, the people who did this work are running around this conference and can tell you that as well, so. Any other questions, or should we open it up to the whole group?
So, yeah, well, thank you again. Right. So we have a couple more minutes before the session ends, so we can open up any last questions from the panel. We've had a lot of great conversation about individual, organizational, hospital, and structural issues that influence access to care and HIV testing. So anything that you have for the panel?
You said that you all contact the clients either face-to-face or on the phone, and you only contact them one time? I mean, to verify that they will get back into care?
Correct.
Okay, and so after that, you change over, and then how do you verify their...
So we contact them one time to ask, are you still interested in getting your care at the core center, which is where they were previously receiving their care. And if they say yes, then we, so it might be like a contact and a half. We go make an appointment for them, give them the appointment information.
Oh, you make the appointment.
Yeah. And so we can follow up later to determine if they did attend that appointment because of the access to the electronic medical record. But yeah, after that initial contact and appointment scheduling, there's no.
Okay.
Any other questions in the
room? I heard a couple of different definitions of age for why MSM. I was wondering if people had any reason of why they chose that age group.
No, I can speak that. I don't think that there's any strict definition of youth in any of the research that I've seen. And I think the reason we looked at 18 to 29 was because that's where we saw the greatest risk or the greatest prevalence.
We defined it as 13 to 29 because according to the CDC definition, adolescence is up until 24, but as Jacques said, based on risk, we decided to extend that to 29.
I guess for us, it wasn't as intrinsic a part of our research, so there wasn't perhaps an intentional like decision on which literature to use in referencing age, but I think the answers were great. Before we thank the panel one last time, just want to invite all of you to the HIV Section Social. It will happen on Tuesday evening. We'd love to see you all there. The exact location is in your book or on the website. It's somewhere in the blog, but I don't remember it. But it's a great way to connect with people who are in your work area, follow up conversations. There's good food and tips and so the cash bar. Please join us for that. Thank you all for wonderful presentations. Come and chat with us.